Now, I'm looking at those feet. In verse 41, Daniel chapter 2. I'm saying that because I understand last night I started reading and forgot to tell you what chapter I was in. I was severely reprimanded by my pastor for doing that. And I said, look, I spoke for an hour and a half and you got one little thing to pick on me for. I am trying my best to make sure every reference is given to you. In Daniel 2 and in verse 41, and whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. But there shall be in it the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest the iron mixed with the miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not clave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. I am not satisfied, and I'm only giving you, forgive me for, you know, taking my dirty laundry in public, I am not satisfied with the way the people explain this clay to me. They lead me to believe that the iron and the clay mingle together into some third substance. But as I read it, it is part iron, part clay. Do I know what the iron is? Well, of course I do, because that's identified as the horrible beast, which is the Empire of Rome. And in the days of Constantine, he divided that empire into two parts. And in one part, he went eastern, built a city and called it after himself, named Constantinople, so that there are two legs. In the last day, when the great tribulation comes, then we are directed to the feet. Not the foot, but to the feet. If you listen to the expositors of prophecy, they will lead you to believe that Rome revives. But if I read this accurately, it's not only a revival of the western foot. It demands a revival of the eastern foot. And the iron, which belongs to a revived Roman Empire, is mingled with another substance, and that substance is pictured for us as clay. It is volatile. It is impossible for this weighty image to stand on nothing but clay mingling with the feet. What is the clay? As I see it, some other world power has to come into that anti-Christian age. There must be a union. It is not simply the European Economic Community, the 10 nations improvised, but 10 nations eventually of Europe. It's more than that. What more is it? What are the world power plays a part? And I only ask the question, is it at all possible that the clay could be represented by the Muslim world and that a union will take place between them, merging their economies? And is it possible that the last great emperor of the world comes out of the clay and not out of the iron? Is that possible? Because if it is, it says, well, there could be significance to that line in the sand. And it may be that we are closer to the end than we have previously thought. That's one of my arguments. Let me give you my second argument. My second argument is the prophetic period apparently has already passed. I need to explain that to you. When I speak about a prophetic period, I'm drawing an assumption, and I will admit that it is an assumption, that when God made the world in 6 days and he rested on the seventh, that the history of mankind falls into the same pattern. That when on the fourth day the sun, the moon, and the stars were placed in their orbits, on the fourth day of his creative work, the sun, the light of the world, came into the world. You can trace from the birth of my Lord and go back through the Bible to Adam, and you have approximately 4,000 years between it. The psalmist said in the 90th Psalm and in the 4th verse that 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday when it is past. So that in God's calendar, a day lasts for approximately 1,000 years. Now, if in 4,000 years he brought the sun into the world, on the 7th day, the last 1,000 years, it is the day of rest. And it represents the period of the millennial reign of Christ, when the lion and the lamb will lie down together, and men will take their swords and beat them into plowshares. With that in mind, and it seems to me that leaves a gap of 2,000 years between the time my Lord came in his first advent until the time he comes in the second advent. I've other little, nothing I can build an argument upon, but suspicious things that complement that conclusion. For example, in the parable given by my Lord of the Good Samaritan, when the priest and the Levi had passed and the Good Samaritan came to the person, he picked him up, he put in oil and wine, he put him on his animal, he took him down to an inn. When he got to the inn, he said to the innkeeper, "Here are 2 pennies. I want you to watch this man for me, and I will come back for him. And if I owe you anything when I come back, I will pay it." If you go into Matthew chapter 20, a man goes out to hire people from the marketplace to work in the fields. You're getting an economy level for that day. He hired them for 1 penny a day. Therefore, a penny represents a day period of time. So my Lord said, in the 2 pennies, I am giving you the custody of this man, the sinner redeemed by his blood, for 2 divine days, and then I'm coming back for him. Or you remember the time they came and warned our Lord about Herod. And my Lord said a remarkable thing. The reference I'm talking about is in Luke 13:32. The Lord said, "Go tell that old fox." And in the Greek, it is a feminine word. It has the suggestion that Herod the king was a homosexual. And he said, "Go tell that old fox that today and tomorrow I do cure diseases, and the 3rd day I shall be perfect." Now, there is nothing that we can find in the record that will allow those to be 2 literal days of healing followed by 1 day of perfection. The only conclusion we can come to, he's talking about a 2,000-year period of time in which he is doing his cures. And on the 3,000 period of time, then he will be perfected. I can only tell you that if you look at the calendar, I know, and I can't go into argument, but I know that my Lord was born somewhere around 5 or 6 B.C. If this is 1991, then according to that, it's literally 1996 or 1997. And that's the way we calculate time. That is not how a Jew keeps time. All prophecy is given with a different calendar than the one we keep. And instead of having 365 days, they have 30 days per month. Exactly. They keep it by the moon. And if you go by their calendar, we have already passed the year 2000. I'm only suggesting, it's not an argument that's conclusive, it is simply a suggestion. We must be very close to the time when the Lord is coming back again. Let me give you my 3rd argument. My 3rd argument is this. There is a tremendous similarity between biblical and contemporary Babylon. There is a tremendous similarity. I'm going back into last night's discussion, but if you'll remember when I gave you the picture of Babylon under Nimrod, Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon under the Antichrist, And then I shared with you a prophecy that says that Babylon comes back to power again. And we look at the Babylon of our day, we come to the conclusion there's striking similarities between these. Are you aware? I mentioned to you that there was oneness in Babylon. There was economy in Babylon. There was religion in Babylon. In a moment in just passing, I suggested to you all those traits lie in the Babylon of our day. Isn't it remarkable that so recently oil became a world consideration? And that somehow all of it is found, not all of it, but that which has attracted the world and made it an economic center is found there in these lands. And it is placed strategically, this land of Babylon, in the middle of all of that. In the oneness, do you know, they have what they refer to as the Peace of Saladin, one of the men in the days of the Crusaders, who made a covenant of peace with a crusader and his forces, and then only made it with the acknowledgement, I'm going to break it. The moment that I get the opportune moment, I'm going to break it. And he did. And it devastated that particular crusade. The Peace of Saladin is still the policy of the Arab world. You cannot depend on them for any contract. And if I had any voice that I could give to the Secretary of State, I would say, put no dependence on what they promise. I personally believe they have been so hostile to Christianity and to Israel, they will never rest until we are destroyed. When I talk about religion, in the image or the vision that was given to Zechariah, he picked up that talent of lead, and there was a woman. And that woman, I have no question about who that woman is. That woman represents an apostate religion, but I can see that in this place, as I mentioned to you last night, a territory that stretches for 5,000 miles. A population that is one-fifth of the world. An aggressive push toward building it till it becomes the world's superior power in order that they might take over the world. They're not hiding that. They believe that to be their call, and they will gladly sacrifice their lives in order for that to happen. That leaves me again with a little bit of suspicions about what's happening in the sand. Let me go to my fourth. My fourth argument is this, because there is a contextual identification with the King of the North. I said, I can't identify who the King of the North is. You see, what we do, we take a ruler and we go straight north of Jerusalem, and it takes us right to the city of Moscow. Therefore, we know that when you talk about the King of the North, you're talking about communism, which seems to me today to be a lion without any teeth. I don't know. But if I say, can they identify who the King of the North is? Contemporary with Daniel is the prophet Ezekiel into power. And Nebuchadnezzar brought it into power of exceeding wealth and greatness. That denies that whatever Isaiah was talking about was his day. The question is, what was Isaiah predicting? My second argument is Scripture. Go back into the context. Look, for example, in chapter 13 and in verse 6. Howl ye, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It shall come as a destruction from the Almighty. So I'm going to take an important weapon that is used by those who deny Babylon a future and say you cannot build your argument on that passage of Scripture. That then brings me honestly to my last argument. I know that Dr. Melton is saying, there's nobody going to believe that one. It's in the book of Zechariah, and it's in the fifth chapter of the book of Zechariah. And I'm going to read for you the seventh of eight different visions that Zechariah had. In the seventh of these eight visions, an angel came and talked with him. Let me just read for you what's given to us in chapter 1 and in verse 1 that introduces this prophecy. In the eighth month, in the second year of Darius. Why is that important? Because if you know your history, you know this is at the earliest 17 years after Babylon was destroyed. So whatever he is talking about, it finds no fulfillment in Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. It's the prophet Jeremiah ministering in the city of Jerusalem. Let me ask you to look in Jeremiah chapter 1, and let me read for you what's found in Jeremiah chapter 1 and in verse 15. Here's God calling Jeremiah to become a prophet. It's in the 13th year of Josiah. And he said, "For lo, I will call all the families of the kingdoms of the north, saith the Lord. And they shall come, and they shall set every one his throne at the entering of the gates of Jerusalem, and against all the walls thereof round about, and against all the cities of Judah." So when he called Jeremiah, he called him to survive until the collapse of the city of Jerusalem. Who's going to cause it to collapse? The answer is, that's going to be a power of the north, or the families of the kingdom of the north. We forget sometimes that our geography and their geography is slightly different. Because if you were to go directly east from Jerusalem, you'll go to the city of Babylon. But if Babylon is going to become a power against this nation, which it eventually did, and Jeremiah didn't know that, if it becomes a power against this nation, in order for it to get there, it has to go up the Mesopotamian Valley and come in from the north. And therefore, in chapter 20 of Jeremiah, the first inkling that Jeremiah gets, it's found in verse 4. And it's given in the latter part of that verse, Jeremiah 20, verse 4, "And I will give all Judah into the hand of the king of Babylon, and he shall carry them captive to Babylon, and shall slay them with the sword." So that when God said to Jeremiah, "The king of the north is coming against you," it was Babylon that he was talking about. I just raise the question, is there any possibility that the king of the north is still Babylon? Is that a possibility? That only has to be put into the computer and pressed in with all the other pieces of information that we have. That brings me to my fifth argument. And that is, because the future power is described clearly in the book of Revelation as being Babylon. Why then do we question it? Incidentally, if you go to the prophecy teachers of our day, they will tell you that it cannot be Babylon because Babylon is lying in waste. And there is nothing but windswept sand going over whatever debris might be left of the ancient city. Therefore, we know it is not Babylon. Instead of being Babylon, we believe that it is Rome. That's what they tell us. But you see, my question is this. Why then did they so clearly identify in the book of Revelation that Babylon was the power? And why, when I read about it, for example, I read about Ethiopia, I read about Libya, I read about Egypt in Ezekiel 38, 39, why is it those names represent the countries identified today, but Babylon doesn't? Why not? I'm not saying it is. I'm only raising a question. It seems, if you read, for example, about it, you will notice, if I can just give you the reference of Revelation 9, verse 14, "Loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates." Why am I referring to Euphrates? That is the city in which Babylon is built. Why must I know in the anti-Christian world that four great evil powers reside there? Or if I read for you in Revelation 16 and verse 12, the waters of the great river, referring to Euphrates, thereof were dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. When an east wind power is coming to deal with the Antichrist during that period of time, there is some force at the river Euphrates that is stopping his passage. It's not simply because it's a river, because they had to cross over the river Tigris to get there. But that wasn't an obstacle to them. It's the Euphrates that is the obstacle. Again, I'm only asking the question. Is it possible that when the Spirit of God called that future kingdom Babylon, that he perhaps meant by that Babylon? That'll bring me down to my last argument. And you can tell I'm saying nothing conclusive. I'm trying my best to avoid it. If I were playing baseball tonight at a Dodger uniform, I'm doing everything I can to avoid saying anything positively and just giving you little pieces of information, the conclusion of which may be perhaps something significant is going on in the Middle East. My last argument is simply this. The similarities that exist between Nebuchadnezzar, that future man of sin known as the Antichrist, and this man called Saddam Hussein. I am uncomfortable about these. You remember Nebuchadnezzar? When God gave him the dream of a great man, and as he looked at that great man, he then decided he would build the image I mentioned to you last night. An enormous statue that, according to the Hebrew, is chiseled out of gold. It is one complete solid piece of gold chiseled in the form in which he wanted to be given. And the people of the land required, knowing that it would be offensive to those that worship Jehovah, everybody at a given moment must worship that image. Is that not exactly the same that the man of sin is going to do? Isn't that exactly the role of the false prophet? That he gives power to the image and he requires the world to bow down and worship the image? And those that do not must give their life? If that is true, what a similarity lies between the future Babylon and the past Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar. And again, what an uncomfortable and uncanny similarity between Saddam Hussein. You are aware of the fact that Saddam has exactly the same complex. Saddam makes no bones about it. He believes that he is the reincarnated Nebuchadnezzar. And he believes that with all of his soul. He believes that whatever it was that Nebuchadnezzar was in an ancient Babylon, that Allah or Allah has required that he fulfilled that role today. You look at the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. It went all the way down to the Arabian Sea. It went all the way north through Syria up to Turkey. It went down through Lebanon. It went down through Israel. It went down into Egypt. And this maniac had it in his mind, I'm traveling that same route. And Kuwait was only step number one. After that, Saudi Arabia. After that, any countries that lie between him and Israel. And he's got this fascination with being a Nebuchadnezzar. So that, as I say, it makes you feel a little bit uncanny. Not only does he believe he is Nebuchadnezzar, he believes that it is his role to rebuild that ancient city of Babylon. Had you to go there 15 years ago, my description would have been accurate. It is a desolate place, windswept. The Arabs didn't put their tents there. It is a different picture today. If I look at the ancient city of Babylon, it lay on both sides of the Euphrates. There was a bridge that spanned across it of 33 feet. It was protected by a great double wall that was 28 miles, and it was 27 yards thick. It had access by 100 gates of brass, and the palace of the king had 700 rooms. It had canals that went through it so they could stand against oppression from an outside force by having water coming into the canals. And if you read the story of the collapse of Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon, it was the drying up of those canals that let the invading armies come in. Saddam Hussein believes that is my goal. I'm going to build this city of Babylon. I'm going to make it the world center of commerce. I'm going to make it the world center of religion. He has thousands of people having done all the excavation work they needed. They have 60 million bricks already in place. And every 6 feet, there's an inscription that goes into the wall that says, the Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar was reconstructed in the era of Saddam Hussein. It's expected that in 1994, it'll be a completed project. Ancient Babylon is not coming back to life. What's going to happen out there in the desert? I'll say it again, I do not know. But I do raise question. Is it at all possible that what we are looking at is the scheduled events that bring in the end of the age? We will not be here if it is that final battle. I remind you, the final battle that introduces this anti-Christian age is not fought in the desert, it's fought in Israel. But Saddam has made his mind up, according to the reports, that he's going to fight it there anyway. And today, a Russian ship was found trying to steal equipment so that Saddam could have spare parts. And I don't know if Saddam could possibly be the king of the north, or could he possibly be the Antichrist. But I'm going to keep my heart on alert. I close with this simple thought. Whenever I look at these events, I realize it's easy for us to become overexcited. I go back to the days of Napoleon, and prophecy preachers were preaching in that day that he was the Antichrist, because the Antichrist is referred to as Apollyon, and Napoleon is very close to that. So that must mean he is the Antichrist. And it's easy for us to get heated and excited about it. I'm not concerned about the people that point erroneously but keep us alert. I wish they wouldn't do it. However, I am more concerned about the people who don't care. The events that are happening will happen if they happen, and who cares about it? And if the church is going to go first, who cares about that? If we are already saved, we're going to go, so what difference does it make? I simply remind you, because numerics in the Bible are significant, 10 is the number of man's completeness. 6 is the number of man's fallibility. And if you count 10 generations from Adam, it brings you to Noah. If you count 10 generations from Noah, it brings you to Abraham. If you count 10 generations from Abraham, it brings you to Boaz. If you go 10 generations from Boaz, it brings you to Uzziah, the king that died. If you go 10 generations from there, it brings you to Zerubbabel, the heir to the throne that had no kingdom, that led the people back into their promised land. And if you go 10 generations from there, it leads you to Joseph, the husband of Mary, who bore my Lord into the world. In other words, time with God is accurate. He's not waiting for world events to get in shape so that he can suddenly pounce on them in the picture. There were two people that were in the temple when my Lord was circumcised, waiting to see him. How did they know? There's a prophecy in Daniel that will take you from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build the city until the coming of Messiah the Prince. And it's 483 years. And a great thinker that was the J. Edgar Hoover of Great Britain wrote a book on the coming prince. Sir Robert Anderson was his name. And he took a Jewish calendar and day by day laboriously traced from that commandment until the day that Jesus rode into the city of Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. And he measured them to be exactly what had been predicted. I want you to know, God is not idly looking at things falling into shape. God is putting them into shape. And when God works, His work is meticulously fine. I say to you, it is high time that we awake out of sleep, for now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. What's going to happen on the 15th? I do not know. But I do see possibilities that something bigger than a lunatic standing in opposition to the combined forces of the world is at stake. It is possible. If it is, the question that you have to answer is, are you ready? Is it possible, because this happens every place I go to preach, there are people who name the name of Christ who live with plaguing doubts and they're not really sure if they're saved. I wouldn't dare face an uncertain life without a full assurance of salvation. And especially at a moment like this, when I don't know what is about to happen, I'd want to make sure I know that my soul is safe in Christ. That's why I'd like to spend a moment in invitation. Some of you may be here that have never followed your Lord publicly in baptism. Don't be ashamed at His coming. Some of you are here that need a church home where you can serve the Lord. Some of you are here with loved ones and friends who are not in the kingdom and you've never carried a burden for them. It is important at this time. It is said of Ahithophel, who spoke as of the oracles of God, that when he saw his counsel was rejected, he went home and set his house in order and hanged himself. But he put his house in order first. Maybe it's time to do a little bit of spiritual house cleaning.